you know, first impressions are so important in everyday life, and it's no different on Facebook. If the first thing that they remember about you is that you solved a problem for them, that sticks. That's yeah. gonna last forever. On the other hand, if they're like the people that you and I see in our Facebook feed, where it's just, you know, buy this course and you can make all this money and it makes us feel kind of slimy, that's gonna stick too.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Welcome, Billy, to the Hooked on Startups podcast. So can I tell everyone a little bit about you?
You may.
So you are you're a Facebook advertising guru, basically. So I'm going to say the word, and you're not going to challenge it. And if you are, I'm going to edit it. But the reason that you're so good at what you do is because you've done it yourself from the inside looking out. So there's a big difference from people that run ads for other people, because you don't have that same sort of feeling. So you set up, so your background is that you were a corporate guy.
I was.
You were running marketing for, was it a big power company?
It was actually a consulting company, and we worked in the power industry. So we worked with big publicly traded utility companies, federal agencies like Department of Homeland Security, Department of Energy, and we did project development for them. So if they wanted to do a big solar farm or a wind farm, I was the guy. I did mainly financial modeling. I would basically come in and say, make a big spreadsheet and say, yeah, you're going to make money on this project, or now you're going to lose money.
Okay, yeah. So with most solar stuff, yeah. I mean, I having done a little bit of that is normally the second bit.
It's more complicated than that, but as you can imagine. But yeah, that was the gist of it. Yeah, very very buttoned up. Professional environment, much different than what I'm doing now.
But on the side, so you have this amazing story where you were a homebrew expert. So, and when what happened was that grew, which is pretty much everybody's dream.
Yeah.
To take something that you're passionate about, which is obviously not the job at that time, but you were creating some amazing sort of homebrew results. So you started a blog, and then one thing led to another. So, and we now have the Homebrew Academy, which I think has thousands and thousands of successful people. So you created this blog that became a site, that became an academy.
Yeah.
I guess you've just sold out. So you're probably recording this from a beach somewhere with a backdrop of books, which is clearly a green screen.
That's not real. I'm just trying to look smart. Yeah, there's a cabana right behind me and some babes in bikinis, and they got Mai Tais waiting. Yeah, that's not real. We are actually selling the site right now, but it's been a real fun journey. And you know, I had that the job was great. I love the people I worked with, but I always had this entrepreneurial bug.
So yes,
sure you can relate to, right? Ever since I was a kid, it was more that I wanted to be not so much an entrepreneur or business owner. It was more an inventor. I was always coming up with mostly really stupid ideas, but I was always inventing things in my mind. Never actually, of course, made anything. But then as I got older and learned more about business, that kind of morphed into entrepreneurism. And I think they come from a similar place, those two aspirations. You know, you want to create value. You want to create something from scratch that no one's seen before. I think they're both very creative endeavors.
I've got to ask you, what were some of the things that you created as a kid? I had this sort of amazing vision of these huge Robinson machines, you know.
The closest I ever got to actually doing something was, I actually worked with one of those companies you see on TV all the time. I think George Foreman is always, isn't it George Foreman? Call my friends at Invent Help, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I got pretty close. It was the stupidest thing. It was a way to transport hangers, like hangers that you hang your clothes on.
Yeah.
Cause I was a little bit older. I was a freshman in college. And I would go back and forth to the dorm, you know, after our vacations. And I would always have all these damn wire hangers, and I would throw them into a trash bag, and it would always go through. It was just a nightmare. So I thought I could create some kind of a carrying case shaped like a hanger that would zip up, and I could put all the hangers in there. Then I realized that hangers cost like 25 cents.
And which is where the business brain kicked in, yes.
Yeah, then the business brain kicked in and I started to realize the economics of it. But they were still saying, oh, this is a brilliant idea. And if you just pay us $10,000, we'll market it for you and bring it to all the trade shows. Be careful with those companies.
That's where you discovered the power of marketing.
Exactly. Yeah, they don't exactly make money the way that you think. Yeah, so that was one of my harebrained ideas.
It's funny because one of my best buddies from the UK has made hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm not joking, from selling coat hangers. He cornered the market. This was a few years ago.
No kidding.
No, I promise you. And he ended up supplying all the hangers to all the major department stores. So, I mean, you've got to do it.
Yeah.
So you were close. You were really close with your idea.
Yeah, the hanger tote was getting close. This is what I call it, the hanger tote.
We can cut this bit out, by the way, if you want.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's a funny story. No, but... I started that job and, you know, got my MBA and I was all set. You know, I thought I knew my career path, but I just always had that itch. And so it was the first week that I was working there. I started to build this beer blog on the side. I was like, I got to do something, you know, I got to do something in my evenings here. I got a lot of free time, single guy. That's what I did. And I started writing beer reviews and I started doing homebrewing tips, video tips. So this is right when YouTube was taking off and there wasn't a whole lot of online video then.
Yes.
And out of all the posts that I would write, those video tips would always do the best because the video was new and also homebrewing, you can probably attest to, kind of a difficult process, right?
Yes. It's complicated. I know. I've poisoned myself many times.
Yeah.
And I have created some of the most disgusting liquids ever known to man in the name of homebrewing.
Yeah, I was exactly there myself. So yeah, and that happens to a lot of brewers and they get discouraged and then they give up on the hobby and then they have all these buckets and kettles collecting dust in the closet and it's no fun. So they were really getting value out of these videos and I thought, you know what? What if I can just string them together and put them into a course?
Wow.
So I was following this this website called CopyBlogger back then and they teach copywriting and marketing skills and they came out with a course, their own course called Teaching Sales. And I thought, that is perfect. Yeah, teaching sells. I think it's still around. And so I went through that, released the course. It did great. Fast forward about 4 years, and I was making as much from that website as I was from my corporate consulting job. And so I just called my boss one day and put in my 2 weeks, and that was it.
But I'm sure that there was a little bit of a, oh, my God, where is this going to go? Because this is one of the big questions that people have is when they're working. So I just want to talk more about this trigger point where you decide, okay, I'm going to give up my incredibly well-paid grown-up job and end up doing something where I'm completely in control and in charge of my own revenue stream. So how was that decision-making process? So at what point did you think, was it money? Because money can stop, you know, you're thinking, hang on, this is okay at the moment, but what about next month?
Right. It was more so just the control and the freedom, you know, just being able to, and it was kind of cliche, but, you know, dictate my day and just decide exactly what I'm going to do for every hour of that day and not have someone else tell me what that is.
And I think that's the sort of thing that nibbles away at you if you're an entrepreneur. That's that sort of feeling you get in the back of your mind.
Right.
And I guess the moment you get a little bit of success from doing something else, do you find it kind of like blows it out? Your brain says, this is it. We've discovered the answer to everything.
So yeah,
exactly. Leave your job now.
And I got a taste of that too, because what happened was I was working for that company and we started a program where we could work from home.
Little did they know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I was still doing great work for them, but I could sort of run my day differently. I could shift things around. It was okay if I wanted to take an afternoon off and get something done at night. So I got that taste of having more control and really dictating my day. And I really liked it. And I thought, you know what? I could do this every single day for the rest of my life, you know, running my own business. And so, and that's when I knew that I just had to make the leap. And the site was growing a lot, but again, I was only working on it on the weekends and in the evenings because I had this full-time job. And I knew that if I could just take those 40 hours a week and then put that into the site, it could just grow like crazy.
And is that the sort of advice that you would give someone who is working for someone else and has this spark of an idea? What sort of advice would you give them having made that transition?
Yeah, I mean, don't just make the jump without having something, without having a little bit of traction. Unless you have a ton of savings and you can do that and you're pretty confident in it, it can be a gradual thing. Get the term now is side hustle, right? Get a side hustle going. Yeah, so just to give yourself that option where if it comes down to it and your boss is really pissing you off or you just don't like what you're doing anymore, or you hit a ceiling and you can't get a bigger raise or a more important position, it's great to have that little thing on the side, bringing in some money. And you know that if you could take those 40 hours, 50, 60 hours and put it towards that, you could turn it into something really viable where you're making as much as you were at the other job. And really then the sky's the limit. Because a big thing for me was I hated getting paid second. I wanted to get paid first. We had clients, they would pay my bosses paid me.
Yes.
I wanted to flip that around.
I think that's a common thing really where you feel this sort of entrepreneurial gene, as it were. You get to see how the business works and you start deconstructing the various elements and you figure out quite quickly that, you know, is your boss actually bringing value to the business or is this something you could do yourself?
And I would bring up, I always had ideas on how we could grow that company, but you only have so much influence as an employee. There's only so much you can do.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But one of the other guys that I interviewed a couple of months back, one of his suggested ideas was if you're working for someone and you're building this side hustle, try and get some experience within your company where you're the amount of, not liability, but you know, where you're put under a lot more pressure to deliver. So you could almost take on a separate role within your business that gives you a taste of that sort of responsibility of what it's like being, you know, completely responsible for a particular bottom line or for a particular project.
Yeah, that's a great idea. If you can head up a department or a certain project, because that is one of the scary things about becoming self-employed is that it's all on you. There's no excuses. If you can't blame the bosses for not bringing in revenue into the company to then pay you, if you're not making money, it's all your fault, so to speak. So it's great to have that kind of position where you can really control how much you're making or how much you're not making.
So what year was it that you decided to make this leap? Just to get some sort of context, as it were.
2014.
Okay, so that was really, it was when Facebook, I guess, was still trying to find its way. I don't think there was any real Facebook advertising that had any traction. So what made you decide that Facebook was the channel? Because we had, you know, I think MySpace, Twitter, all the different growing technologies at that point.
So that story doesn't so much start with Facebook. It starts with direct response marketing. So when I started the site and I launched the course, I realized that I had to sell the damn thing.
Yeah.
I thought that if I just put a great course up there and I just listed all the modules, people would find me. They would realize how awesome it is. I could give them a free trial. And I tried all sorts of things, all sorts of ways to sell it. And people would just love it and buy it. That wasn't the case. And I thought, you know, I have all this business experience, but you know what they didn't teach me when I was getting my MBA? And I think this is common for most MBAs. They don't teach you how to sell.
Yeah.
They assume that you're working for a big company and someone else, they have a sales team and the money has already been made. And then you can figure out what to do with that money, whether it's in finance, which is looking more to the future, or in accounting, which is looking more into the past, management, operations, that kind of stuff. But there wasn't one course that was on sales.
Yeah.
And there were three big ones. There's sales, and then there's copywriting, which is really salesmanship in print. And that's what I really latched on to. And negotiation. So three really important skills to have in business, probably the most important ones that they just didn't teach me at all.
Yeah.
And so for the beer course, the beer website, it was really copywriting that I discovered that really made that a success. And it was through that course that I discovered that teaching sales. And that got me into this whole world of direct response marketing. And And I realized that you have to, when you're a small business, there's a different playbook for small businesses versus big businesses, big brands. And small businesses, you can't just waste money on branding and t-shirts and billboards, TV commercials, that kind of crap, where you can't measure it. And you're just not sure if it actually produces a sale or not. You're just going to, you're just building your audience, right? But that doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah.
So I got really hooked on copywriting. I just love the idea that you could change a headline and make five times what you were making on that same sales page. That was just incredible.
Yeah.
And so I discovered all these famous copywriters like Gary Halbert and John Carlton, Eugene Schwartz. So really copywriting became, in direct response marketing, almost more of a passion than the beer industry and home brewing.
And you say copywriting, was that because of the results that you're getting? So by properly structuring ads, by understanding the key phrases that trigger people's response, you get this sort of instant gratification to a certain point where, you know, you put an advert out there with one set of copy, you can A-B test it with another. So was it that sort of immediate response that spurred you on to realize that that's one of the critical components of advertising?
Yeah. There's so many interesting aspects to it. I mean, there's the writing side of things, and I've always enjoyed writing. It's very conversational writing. That was one thing they didn't like me to do at my old company. We wrote a lot of technical reports, and I was really bad at writing those. You can imagine these reports, very dry, 120-page technical reports for the government. The exact opposite of copywriting.
Sure.
Copywriting should be conversational. It should just be like we're talking here. So I like that aspect. I love science and psychology. There's a lot of buyer psychology that's involved with copywriting and really getting inside people's heads and figuring out what makes them tick. I love that. And then, of course, it's very close to the sale, right? It has one of the biggest impacts on your conversions versus like SEO, where it takes a long time to get results and is very far away from the transaction. Copywriting is right there. And data. I've always been a numbers guy. And like you were saying, split testing. I love testing. And that's really the key to writing high converting copy. Always test your assumptions. And so just all those qualities combined just made it a really attractive field for me.
And I guess this must have been very interesting for you because this was stuff that you probably thought you already knew.
Right.
Bearing in mind, you know, your professional training, your MBA, the fact that you spend a lot of time within a very professional, large organization. But did you find that coming out of that, that there were these real gaps in terms of practical applications without this team, without this big brand behind you?
Yeah, exactly. And the type of marketing that we did there, and it, so we didn't even have a sales team or anything. The type, our marketing budget was spent on writing proposals.
Okay.
So the government would put out a big, they call it an RFP.
Yeah.
And they would email it out to all the vendors, all the government contractors. And we'd be competing against 20 or 30 other companies. We'd write these huge long proposals. That was our marketing. Very, very different than traditional marketing or you know, online marketing, what I'm doing now. So I didn't learn about sales and marketing at that company, and I didn't learn about it in school. So I had to learn it on my own. So exactly, it was a huge gap.
And again, this coming back to what you were talking about before, which was this, you know, the selling course. Were there a lot of areas there which were real aha moments for you that seemed just obvious, but things like where people talk to you, you read about it every day. Make sure that you understand what your client's problem is before you start selling. Were there steps where you think, God, you know, if only I knew this?
Yeah, really the research side of things, which is by far the most boring part of copywriting, and not to me, but most people, and the most boring thing to talk about. No one likes to do research and build customer avatars and all that. But the fact of the matter is, if you can really figure out what makes someone tick, and that was a big aha moment, was really thinking hard about that. What do these people actually want? And going below the surface level stuff. So if someone were advertising something to me, you know, and I was in this 9-to-5 job and they could promise me that I could leave that and start my own business. Well, you know, that's still very surface level. So you have to go deeper and say, does that prospect, what do they really want? Do they want to be on the beach with the Mai Tais and the babes in bikinis? Or do they have a family and they want more free time to play with their children, right? So that's the same thing. You can leave you can leave your 9-to-5 job and you can have one of those two things, but you're going to, depending on who you're talking to, you're going to communicate that very differently, right?
Yes.
So going below the surface and really figuring out what people's desires truly are. And you have so much more leverage there than you do with almost anything else. All the split testing tools and fancy website plugins and pop-ups and retargeting, all that stuff. None of that is as important as really understanding your customer.
I think you're right. So the clients that you work with, tell me a little bit about the people that you help.
Yeah. So I started off in a weird niche in homebrewing, and that's who I started working with, really. Other people in strange, unusual niches. So vegetarian fitness and computer programming and photography and running and detoxing, drumming, all these cool niches. So experts, authors, coaches, people who have expertise in something and want to monetize it.
Okay. And did you find that they all suffered from a common problem, which is, it's like the sort of elastoplast approach where if I can go out, if I can get likes, if I can try and get something viral, if I can get people to share this stuff, then did you find that their understanding of Facebook and other advertising methods was lacking or was focused on completely the wrong, you know, the wrong outcome?
They were very similar to me in that they create a lot of content. They're very generous, love their audience, love their subject matter, and they create a lot of free content, a lot of blog posts, podcasts, and they get a lot of traffic because of it, but not a lot of sales. And they were missing the sales funnel side of things. Having a process to take someone from not knowing you at all to becoming a customer to becoming a repeat customer. That was the biggest thing.
And I think also there's this feeling that, particularly with small businesses, that you need instant results. So if you go onto Facebook and you put an ad, because of the way that Facebook works and because of the way that it's conditioned us, you're looking for those instant results.
Right.
And again, is that something that works, or is that something that where your clients or potential clients need to be educated as to how it works?
They need to be educated. It all comes down to their traffic temperature. You have your cold people who have never heard of you, but they might not even know that they have a problem. And you need to make them aware of you, but first aware that they have this problem. And then you have the warm audience. We can get more into the nuts and bolts of this too with Facebook if you want.
Yes.
Who are aware that they have a problem, but they might not know there's a solution. Or they know that there's a solution, but they don't know who offers it. They just know that there's probably something out there that can help them. And then you have your hot traffic. And those are the people that are just ready to buy. And those are the people that it's okay to show those direct sales ads to, an ad that says, hey, buy now. The problem is a lot of people take those ads where it says buy now and they show it to a cold audience. And that just pisses people off.
And I think you're right, because I see so many ads, as everyone does on Facebook, which is, they're effectively get-rich-quick schemes. So the pain that everyone feels trying to build a business is, how do I get traction? How do I get people to find out more about me? So I'm an open book, as it were, or I'm cannon fodder.
Yeah.
The course is that, yes, of course I want to get 100,000 people on my mailing list by tomorrow afternoon.
Right.
Or I want to instantly learn, you know, how to get 1 million Facebook likes. But your experience is that it takes time, because you're talking about moving someone through that narrative arc from,
right,
first of all, understanding that they have a problem.
Right.
And how do you do that? Do you do that through marketing or through advertising, or what is your approach?
Yeah, it's really, so I forget who I heard say this, but good marketing makes sales irrelevant or unnecessary. So if you do the marketing right, you really don't have to do the hard selling, because marketing is really just education and making people aware of these problems that they have and the potential consequences of those problems, and then educating them on all the potential solutions, and then coming in and saying what you offer and why you think your solution is the best for them. So the way to do it is to really lead with value. Give first, give before you ask. So again, it comes back down to research. So most people don't do nearly enough research before I hopped on this interview, I was doing research for a Facebook advertising campaign, and it was just, it's a massive spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Huge spreadsheet of all these, for this client, all these potential fishing holes where we could find a cold audience. And I mean, there must be at least, I'm not done yet, but like at least 50 different websites on there. But we're not going to come in and show them an ad that says, hey, buy this course now. We're going to do some research and figure out what their exact pain points are and what the most burning and urgent pain point is.
Yeah.
Because people have a lot of different problems, but you want to start with what's really top of mind for them. Like, what are they actually thinking about? What's, when they wake up in the morning and they're making their coffee, what's running through their mind that makes them think, ah, shit, I really got to take care of that.
Yeah.
Now, and coming in with a really specific solution. And so that, it positions you as an authority. You know, first impressions are so important in everyday life, and it's no different on Facebook. If the first thing that they remember about you is that you solved a problem for them, that sticks. That's going to last forever. On the other hand, if they're like the people that you and I see in our Facebook feed, where it's just, you know, buy this course and you can make all this money and it makes us feel kind of slimy, that's going to stick too. And that's not the first impression that I want to give, you know, my clients or my clients' customers. So really leading with value is the most important thing.
And also, I mean, let's just talk a little bit about the Facebook algorithm or the fabled algorithm. I mean, what most people don't really realize is that the Facebook that they're seeing is very different to the Facebook that someone next door to them could be seeing.
Oh yeah, very different. Yeah.
I mean, everyone, you sort of assume that when you put something up there, why are all my friends not clicking on it?
And yeah.
What people don't realize is that no one's seeing it. You know, or that you're assuming that everyone is in the same boat of you.
It's yeah.
Like a cinema, you're all watching the same movie. But
you're seeing a highly customized experience. I mean, look at it this way. Facebook has to make money, and they have to do it from one of two ways. They could charge you to access Facebook. You could pay 10 bucks a month and that gets you Facebook. They're not going to do that, right? And social networks don't work that way, because the more people use social networks, the more valuable they become. So the other option is advertising. So you're not going to have Facebook unless there's advertising. And there's only so many spots. There's only so much real estate for those posts on the newsfeed. There's other placements which we can talk about, but the newsfeed is the one that most people know. You log into Facebook, you see your homepage, all these posts are flying by. Those are limited, and people's attention is limited. So who are they going to give preference to in the newsfeed? Someone who's paying them money or someone who's not paying them money? Now, of course, it can't be all ads too. It can't be 100% ads, because then everyone's going to leave Facebook. So they have to think about the user experience too. And that's why there's a lot of strict rules about what you can and can't say in your Facebook ads. But yeah, you are seeing a highly customized experience. Most people are logged into Facebook all the time, especially because of mobile. You think about it, you fire up your Facebook app on your phone, you don't have to log in, you're already logged in, right?
Correct, yeah.
And most websites nowadays have the Facebook Pixel installed. You can see this for yourself. If you install on Chrome, it's the Facebook Pixel Checker, and it'll turn blue when you're on a website that has their Pixel installed. The Pixel is just a piece of tracking code. So they know what websites you visit, and they know what pages you like on Facebook. What's a page that you like on Facebook?
Some of the marketing stuff. So there's two or three groups that are marketing groups that I think have really good content. So I'll go back to those, you know, daily.
Right. Yeah. I like a bunch of marketing pages too. I like some sports pages. I'm a big Baltimore Orioles fan. You know, there's political pages, there's foodie pages, you know, beer pages, right? So every time you click that like button, not just on a page, imagine that you don't like this. Maybe it's a brewery and you don't like them on Facebook, but their post shows up in your newsfeed and it's a new beer that's out and you just click like on that post. Well, you just told Facebook something.
Yeah.
So when you think about that, and now think about everything you put in your bio on Facebook, why do you think they always encourage you to fill out your bio? Because they want more data about you. They want to learn about you. They can tell every action that you take on there. So that's all. It's one, crafting a highly customized experience for you. But two, and more of the business reason, is because they can use that for their advertising and to help advertisers out. So we can really customize our campaigns to find the right prospects.
And I think that's really coming back to your research thing, because again, I know from my experience from talking to, you know, hundreds of other people, that the typical entrepreneur approach is ready, fire, aim.
Yeah.
In other words, Facebook, you know, I know Facebook because I'm on it every day. So therefore I'm an expert on Facebook. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take someone else's copy. I'm going to copy that and I'm going to try and make that work. But in the absence of understanding who your potential client is, or the avatar, as you say, all that's going to end up is I'm going to end up subsidizing Facebook with my capital.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they will gladly take your money. You know,
so let's now talk about things like likes. So what I can get in exchange for my money without knowing anything are things like likes and shares potentially. And so there are some metrics on Facebook that almost lead you to believe that you're getting results.
Right.
When in fact you're not, or when in fact you're actually getting the opposite potential effect. So what are the bear traps that you need to avoid?
So we call those vanity metrics, likes and shares and all that, that again, you can't pay the bills with likes. That's not to say they don't have their place, but it needs to be part of an overall strategy. That can't just be the end game, is to get a bunch of likes. And I understand that, yeah, it we can't help it. We go to a Facebook page that has 10 million likes and we're impressed, right? We're like, holy shit, they have a lot of likes. So there may be some value there, but again, how much of that wow factor translates into revenue.
Yeah.
So you want to start with the end in mind. You know, start with whatever you want that final conversion to be. For most of my clients, it's selling some kind of training or course or consulting package, and then work backwards from there. So if you take that path, the way likes could factor in is that they could be the very tippy top of your funnel.
Yeah.
Right. So what you're trying to do is there's billions of people on Facebook. You're just kind of putting some bait out there and seeing who takes a nibble. And so you might put a post out there on Facebook and you get a like. And what you can do now, which you couldn't do in the past with Facebook, is you can make an audience of those people, the people that raise their hand and say, hey, I'm interested in that. If it's about growing tomatoes. Yeah, I'm into growing tomatoes. I like your posts with those tips. Cool.
Yeah.
And so then you can take those people and then take them further down the funnel. So that if the like is the tippy top, you can take them down and then eventually get them to opt in for your newsletter and then eventually ask them for the sale.
And is that a relatively new development, the ability to be able to target people that have liked your page?
They're rolling out these features all the time. Yeah, there's these custom audiences, they call them. Anything we say is going to be outdated in a week here. But the most recent one they rolled out was for events. So now I'm sure you've seen events on Facebook. You can say yes, no, interested. You can now create an audience of people that, for example, say that they're interested. So maybe you can knock them off the fence that way. You can say, hey, saw you're interested. Well, here's a new bonus we're rolling out at this event, or a new speaker. Now you should really pull the trigger. So it's really, you know, the term for it is micro commitments. You can target people based on these micro commitments that they make. Which really, when you think about it, it leaves no excuse for showing these salesy, slimy ass to people who have never heard of you. If you have that kind of control over the funnel and the process, if you still do that, then you're just being lazy, really.
Yeah, or you don't understand how it works.
Well, that too. Yeah.
You know, and I think what you're saying is you're really beginning to show people that you're helping people understand that there is a process, there is a science to this. You know, it's not spray and pray. And just because Facebook has, you know, more subscribers than there are people on the planet, just if you put an advert in there, it's not going to go anywhere. So you need to put the work in, where you need to bring an expert on board who can tell you how this process needs to work, so that you funnel people down to the ultimate outcome, which is to get them to buy something or to do something on your site. Let's talk about retargeting, because this is a phrase that people hear but are not entirely sure what it means.
Yeah, so it used to be retargeting was you go to Amazon and what's something you bought recently on Amazon?
A book.
Yeah,
so I'm not really original that way. Do they sell other stuff?
Oh, that was going to be something more fun. Come on, maybe.
Okay, I bought a a recorder, handheld Zoom H4N Pro recorder, which is fantastic.
Oh, I love that thing. Isn't that great?
It is brilliant, actually. Yes,
I think that thing's amazing. Yeah. So imagine that you were shopping at Amazon and you added it to your cart, and then you got distracted. The phone rings and you forget to buy it, and then you come back and you're on Facebook later, and what do you know? The H4N shows up in the right hand sidebar, and you're like, "How the hell is this thing following me around the internet?" That's what we used to think of as retargeting, and it still works that way too. The classic e-commerce abandoned shopping cart. Now, all those things, the world of retargeting is much bigger. So all those things that I was talking about, where you create an audience of people who maybe liked one of your posts or shared a post or like your fan page or just visit your website, land on a blog post and then leave, you can retarget all those people.
Wow.
You can retarget people that opted in for your email list. And so yes, retargeting is really just targeting people who, I was talking about the traffic temperature, targeting those people who are getting warmer and warmer, right? Yes. So when you targeted, not retargeted, they might've been cold. Now you're retargeting. So you're moving them down the funnel. So retargeting really is the key to making a sale.
And what we were talking about originally is, which is copy. So we have all of these targeting technologies. We have the ability to capture what you refer to as micro commitments. Mm-hmm. We have the ability to focus in on particular audiences. How important is copy? Is that rendered irrelevant by these technologies, or is it made even more important?
It's super important. There's the creative, which is the ad itself, which includes the image. The image is really important too, but the copy is very, very important. And the sole purpose of copy is to get someone to take an action. Again, you have the branding world, you have the big ad agencies that write the clever slogans, like the Mad Men guys, yep, right? And they're writing jingles and things. And they call that, they have their own copywriters, they call that copywriting too. That's a very different type of copywriter than the direct response copywriter.
Yes.
And, you know, I got some books here, like Copywriting Handbook.
Wow,
like,
okay.
Right. So that this is copywriting. This is more salesmanship in print. They want you to take an action.
Yeah.
And it's not always to make a sale. It might be, if it's a Facebook ad, to click on it and then opt in for a free goodie, a free ebook or something. So the way that the copy is written can make a big difference. And I've tested this a lot. And the headline is the most important thing. It needs to really stop people in their tracks and make them read the rest of your ad. But yeah, you can show two different ads, one with a certain type of copy, maybe appealing to a certain emotion. Maybe it's appealing to someone's status. They want to feel important. And then maybe you write another ad where you're appealing to a different emotion. Maybe it's more about freedom. And this can perform very differently.
Yeah, it's funny because you talk about emotion as well. Again, so what I've learned is that emotion is the thing that triggers response. And you talk about elevating people.
Yeah.
So in other words, there's one quote I read the other day, which is, you know, are you ready to move on from Victoria's Secret? Which is this idea that, okay, you've bought Victoria's Secret, but now here is something beyond that. So it's signed, I guess it's, you're trying to find those hooks, those things that grab my attention for that nanosecond that stops the scroll.
Right.
Is that the real enemy of Facebook? Is this sort of continual scroll?
Yeah, you need to do it, what they call a pattern interrupt. You know, it's people's pattern to just, that's what I do with my thumb, scroll right down my smartphone. You got to make people stop in their tracks. And it's a combination of the text in the ad and the headline and the image. And if you do your research right, what you write and what you put in the image is going to really speak to people, not just because it gets their attention. I mean, you know, it's the classic ad, sex. Now that I've got your attention, let me tell you about this investment, right?
Yes.
That doesn't work. Yeah, sure, you got their attention, but now they hate you and they're never going to buy anything. So it's really speaking to what's top of mind for them. And the emotions are key. I love studying old classic ads and those headlines. And one of my favorites is, they all laughed when I sat down at the piano, but once I started to play. It's a famous John Caples. I'm not sure if you've heard of that one.
No, but I can, yes.
There's been a lot of knockoffs from that since then. And, you know, so there's a lot of emotion. Now, it's not a whole lot of words, but there's, you know, there's a whole underdog story embedded, yes, in that. And you just have to keep reading. And that's really the goal of the headline. It's a big mistake people make with headline writing is that they think that the headline has to sell the product. It doesn't. The headline needs to get people to read the first sentence of your advertisement. And the first sentence of your advertisement, the only goal of that sentence is to get them to read the second sentence, sure, and so on and so on.
And that's, I think that's critical. So all these likes and shares and this quest for virality really, or for a viral ad is really leading you down the wrong place. So how important is social proof? So this concept that no one wants to be the first person on the dance floor, do you find that you need to build some social proof first before you go into an ad campaign, or will the ads that you write be sufficiently powerful to transcend that?
Yeah, you want to write ads that get you shares and get you likes, because then that's going to bring down your costs. If someone's sharing the ad to all their friends and then they start clicking, that's when you get that momentum and you're going to be paying less for those clicks or for those leads. So I'll give you a good ninja tip for Facebook advertising. When you create new ads, let's say you're testing two different audiences. You're testing, say, people who visited your website and people who are fans of your Facebook page. But it's the same exact ad, same image, same copy and everything. When you do that, Facebook will create two separate ads, meaning they're at two different URLs. Every ad has its own home URL. So let's say that you got a 100 shares between the two of them, split evenly, 50-50. It'd be much more powerful. There would be more social proof if it was just one ad that had 100 shares on it, right? That's more impressive. Cool. So what you can do then is you can use the same ad, the same URL for both of those. And you can still test them. You can still test the different audiences. But you're channeling all that social proof onto the same ad. So all the likes, the comments, the shares are all going to one place instead of being diluted between all these different unique ads.
Wonderful. So I get it. So you can try all these different ads, find one that really works, and then you're right. Everyone wants to have an ad that has, you know, 1,000 shares or 1,000 likes rather than.
Right. And another thing you can do too is if you think about it, like, you know, let's say you're showing an ad for your podcast, who's more likely to like and share and comment on that ad? Your existing email list or someone who's never heard of you?
Exactly.
Existing email list.
Of course.
Yes. So what you can do is start with them.
Yeah.
Build up that social proof and then roll it out to the cold audience. And the cold audience is like, wow, this thing is really popular. Look at all these likes and shares, not knowing that you started with people who already love you.
Yes. And again, it is this scientific step-by-step approach that I think is missing with so many advertising approaches that you see. I guess with the people that you work with, you must have some very happy faces when they understand the science behind it and begin to see, you know, the results.
Yeah. It's all about having systems in place. And I think a lot of that comes back to that work that I did in the power industry, where a lot of my coworkers were engineers and I learned about systems and processes. And I thought when I first made that beer site that if I just had a page on, a link on the navigation that said courses, that everyone visiting the site would see that up there, click it, read it, and buy. The way I look at that now, and that's how most of my clients think too. If I just put the link on my site, everyone who visits the site is going to buy, or a lot will. You got to look at those people like icing on the cake. They're just bonus customers. You really have to bring them through a process.
And I think it's a bit like, it's all about understanding that Facebook is a set of processes.
Yeah.
So in other words, you need to understand how those processes work so that you can leverage those. In the same way that with the stock market, a lot of the stock market activity is driven by machines and by algorithms that react to certain things happening.
Yeah.
It's almost like if you understand what the algorithms are, or there's a balance of human nature on one side, but also understanding how your information is going to be presented and how important things like the relevance score is.
A good example of that is with, so Facebook has an amazing algorithm. I mean, they got some of the smartest computer scientists on the planet and it's incredible, but it needs data for it to work. It needs to learn. Right. And so a mistake that people make is they'll create all these different ad sets and they'll split their budget. It'll be a small budget usually to begin with, and they split it between all these ad sets, and Facebook optimizes at the ad set level. So you choose your objective. So let's say that you chose conversions for your campaign objective. You want to get email opt-ins for, let's say it's a free video. Well, it can find you, Facebook can find you the perfect people to opt in for that based on all that data that they had, what we talked about earlier and everything you like on Facebook, the sites you visit. But if you're splitting your budget and it doesn't have that much data to work with, it can't optimize. It never gets off the ground. So what you want to do is either increase your budget or start with fewer ad sets. Facebook now, they're saying you want at least for a conversion campaign, I think it's 15 to 25 conversions per week.
Yeah.
For that, for their algorithm to really work. Or the other thing you can do, if you don't think you can get that many conversions, you don't really have a budget, you can optimize for something that's a little bit higher up the funnel. Yeah. So if the funnel is clicks to a landing page to email opt-in, you can optimize for clicks.
Yeah.
Not quite as good as an opt-in, but it's a proxy for it. And then once you do that, then you're going to get more clicks, you're going to get more conversions, and then you can switch over. Once you are getting those, say, 20 per week, then you can switch over, make a new campaign where you optimize for conversions. But you have to give it that data to work with. It needs to learn.
Yes. So in other words, be focused on like a handful of different ads and put all of your information or all of your capital, your ad spend into that, because there's no benefit to having the same amount of spend spread over a long period, because the data that you get will be much better if you put all of your budget into one or two and get the data back very quickly.
Yeah, of course. And there's exceptions to all this, and people, you know, you should learn the rules first and then break them. So people yes. do things differently and it works for them. But in general, if you have a budget, you want to spend that quicker versus spreading it out over a long period of time to get that data quicker. It's like your investment. It's your kickstart fee into Facebook, sure. right? So don't plan on making any money from that. You're just getting data and learning which ads work and which ads don't. And yeah, and if you have a limited budget, try to put it into fewer ad sets so that it can season that pixel.
Yes, well, which is brilliant. Well, look, thank you for some of the most amazing, relevant, you know,
no problem.
Clear advice. So I'm going to come on to how people can contact you shortly, but I have my questionnaire that I want to ask you now. So forget
Let's
about
do it.
Facebook stuff. So this is a questionnaire that I borrowed from James Lipton of Inside the Actor's Studio. So we're going to lighten it up a little bit. So for all of you whose heads are exploding with all this amazing information from Billy. Billy, first question, what is your favorite word?
Favorite word? Shenanigans.
Shenanigans. Amazing. Okay. That takes the win. That's the.
Has anyone said that one before?
No. Shenanigans, so far, you're number one on the word. So what's your least favorite word?
Solutions, like business solutions, all those vague jargony corporate words that I left behind in my old job.
Yeah.
Synergy, innovation.
That's symbiosis.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I like picture words. I like words that, you know, this is a copywriter speaking. When you write them, you can instantly get an image. I can't picture what the hell solutions looks like, but yeah. I know what a pizza looks like.
Fantastic. So what are you most excited about right now?
I actually have a real legitimate vacation coming up, first time in a while. Not one of these like business trips that I extend by a few days. Yeah. So I'm going to the Outer Banks, North Carolina with about 10 high school buddies.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, wow. Amazing. So what turns you off right now?
You know, I live in LA and the texting and driving, I know it's bad everywhere, but holy shit. You know, and what I've noticed recently is that, you know where they do it? You know, when you're making a left-hand turn at a green light, but there's no arrow and you have to wait yeah. for the cars to come by you. They get so bored waiting there for those 10 seconds that they hop on their phone and start texting in the middle of the intersection. It's like, oh my God. Like we have
I see people driving on the freeway texting. And I just want to put about a 4-mile exclusion zone around my car, you know, to say that if you are texting, then just, because you just think, the moment you hit your brakes, because you know the traffic on the freeways is always stop start.
Yeah.
I always have this terrible feeling that the moment I hit the brakes to avoid the car in front, any second I'm going to hear that crunch.
I know.
As some guy who was sending that email or sending that emoticon, that emoji. That
can you believe it? I'm sure it's not important, whatever the hell they're sending. I had an invention for that. You want to hear it real quick?
Yeah, of course.
So they did this test. You know those digital speeding signs that tell you how fast you're going
yeah.
and they say what
yes.
the speed limit is, and if you're speeding, it starts blinking at you. They did a test. I think it was in Europe, And instead of showing you your speed, they show you one of two things, a smiley face or a frowny face. And it cut down speeding. It was like 50% better than just showing you how fast you were going. If you're under the speed limit, smiley face. If you're over, frowny face. About something like that, maybe in your car, where if you hop on your phone and start texting, it just like somehow show either a frowny face or shows you how your risk of dying just got multiplied by 1,000,000%. And maybe that would make it more real.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Because I think people respond to that because it triggers the, you know, the endorphins. And it's again, that imagery, it feeds direct into the emotions. That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, better than the hanger tote.
Exactly. So what sound or noise do you love?
Waves crashing, ocean.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
People chewing.
Oh, right. And again, there's a thing that I was reading that the people that, that sounds like chewing and crunching noises, it's the people that are closest to you annoy you the most. So if it's your wife or your husband or your mother or father, you know, people that are really close to you, if you hear them crunching, for some reason, it's just amplified.
I've noticed that. Yeah. I don't know why that is.
Strangers, you don't give a crap, basically. But if there's someone you know, you you have to focus on, I don't know why that is.
Maybe it's because with a stranger, I would never say anything. But if it's my brother, then I'm like really close to that. So maybe it's just more real for me. I just notice it more because there's potential for me to do something about it. I just want to scream at him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, what's your favorite curse word?
Clusterfuck.
That's brilliant. Again, listen, you're doing so well. This is not a test, but if it were, you'd be right up there.
Thank you. Top marks.
So we have a shenanigan-driven clusterfuck.
Yeah.
With no solutions.
A clusterfuck of shenanigans, and that's probably how this vacation's going to go.
Sure. Be brilliant. So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Pilot.
Wow, okay. Yeah. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Bean counting. Accounting.
Well, there's a science there, but again, you know, it's a common answer, funnily enough.
It's that whole looking to the past thing. I like to look to
the past. I think that's it. It's that what's been done without having
been done. It's just organizing what's been done before. Yeah.
Wow, amazing approach. And my last question is, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
You won a second lap. Just think about it. If that happened, you could go back down knowing that, you know, for sure that exists. You probably live a lot
differently.
I'm sure
be some sort of Facebook speech like, yes, you've been bonused a second lap.
Right, yeah. Like.
Free with every 1,000 likes, you get a bonus lifetime. But yeah. Billy, thank you for being such a brilliant guest. And my last question really is, how do people get hold of you? How do they find you? How do they tap into this enormous resource, experience, and knowledge that you have?
You know, I'm on all the social media platforms. Just go to my website, billybross.com, BillyBross.com, and I got all the links on there. Best to follow me on Facebook and Instagram. Big surprise, I'm active on Facebook.
You're on Facebook. Well, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a thing now.